Hey, it's Talknosis. We're welcoming back to the show your parasocial best friend, parasocial guru. You know him from podcasts like Hinge Points, Hell of Presidents, Time for My Stories, and Frost Chrisman, and his new podcast, Hell on Earth. Matt Chrisman, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. Matt, you spent almost a year working on this new podcast about the 30 Years' War. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. We're finishing up the last episodes now. It should be out in January.
Okay, amazing. So a whole year's work, a whole year of content just to talk about this very complex this complex situation. Matt, can you tell us what the 30 Years' War is in about 5 minutes?
Well, it was the breakup, really, of the Holy Roman Empire as a effective political unit. The early modern period is this time when, in these conditions of rapid destabilizing economic and ecological and social and cultural factors, you see these dynasties begin to assert themselves as capable of governing these geographic areas and finally begin to overawe the noble classes of these different dynastic regions. And you see that happen in Spain and France and in England, and also in the Holy Roman Empire. But the difference between those and the rest is that the polity of Germany just simply is not capable of being centrally controlled. And the centrifugal forces unleashed by this period basically pull it apart. And the Holy Roman Empire, the 30 Years' War, is sort of the last attempt by the Habsburg dynasty to assert a actual a governing control over this region. And after it's over, with the Treaty of the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, the Holy Roman Empire persists. It persists until Napoleon, but Germany sort of is knocked out of the running, I guess you'd put it, in the competition among these medium-sized states in Western Europe for preeminence. And it's that battle for preeminence that's going to lead to the emergence of capitalism in Low Countries and then in England. And the 30 Years' War is really the story of why, in the place that is sort of the most urbanized, the place that is as the most has the most population, has the greatest dynamism in its economy, Germany is sort of incapable of fulfilling that role, and it all starts in Bohemia, which is a part of the Holy Roman Empire, where and the only kingdom within it where the Protestant Bohemian elites reject the Holy Roman Emperor as their sovereign and invite Frederick V, the only Calvinist elector of the Holy Roman Empire, to become their king, and in so doing kicks off 30 years of horrific bloodshed in which both sides imagine themselves to be trying to assert a religious settlement on the land that will lead in everyone's mind to Christ's return and to heaven on earth. And instead they created, as we're calling the podcast, Hell on Earth.
Yeah, and for people at home, it's just read the Wikipedia article, right? Then come back, watch the show. But literally, millions and millions and millions and millions of people died, right? Like this was, like you're saying, how on earth it must have felt like the end of the world. And people are kind of wondering why are we talking about this on the show now? You know, I'm middle aged. When you get to your middle ages, you either, if you're a person like me, you either become like a Napoleon guy or a World War II guy or like a Holy Roman Empire Habsburg guy, right? But that's not why I'm doing the show. We're going to be talking about the Rosicrucians, the Rosicrucian legends, the actual Rosicrucian groups, come out of this time. We've done a lot of programming about Rosicrucianism on this show. It's not Gnostic in the second century version of the tradition, but it's something that becomes very important later on for feeding into what becomes Gnostic movements, the Gnostic church that I'm part of. So this is a really great way to take a look at its origins. And just like Matt was saying, early Rosicrucianism, all Rosicrucianism, has this utopianism in it, right? The building of the perfect society. So Matt, what role did the Rosicrucians, if they existed, the legends of the Rosicrucians, the paranoid conspiracies about the Rosicrucians, what role did they play in this this conflagration?
Whatever comes later, and honestly, you know way more about what Rosicrucianism becomes in the aftermath of the 30 Years' War than I do. And honestly, I'd be interested to hear some of what happens after my focus on it. But it begins, it sweeps Germany thanks to the circulation, first in manuscript form, and then in 1614 in printed pamphlet form of two anonymously written pamphlets. The first one called the Fama Fraternitatis, or the Discovery of the Fraternity of the Most Noble Order of the Rosy Cross. And these appear in bookstalls in Germany at the same time that the Holy Roman Empire is reaching a real crisis point of legitimacy. The Holy Roman Emperor can no longer credibly stand as an adjudicator between the different sects and the different regions and the different religious confessional camps within the empire anymore. He is increasingly seen by Protestants as a advocate for and the leader of the Catholic camp within the empire, and as such, someone that they have to consider not their sovereign, but rather an enemy, the threat to them. So you've got, by this time, the Protestant Union has been created among the Protestant princes, spearheaded by Frederick V of the Palatinate, and the Catholic League is formed in response, spearheaded by Maximilian of Bavaria. And there is a growing sense that some sort of confrontation, some sort of holy war is going to emerge. And in this ferment comes this pamphlet, this series of these two pamphlets, back to back. The second one is called the Confessio Fraternitatis, or the Confession of the Laudable Fraternity of the Most Honorable Order of the Rosy Cross, written by all the learned of Europe. And the first one is written in German. The second one is in Latin for a more educated and esoteric audience. And the gist of these pamphlets is that there exists a secret society of learned, godly men who live in a city of light, and where they comport one another, where they comport themselves honorably, where they spend their time learning, exchanging information, becoming essentially immortal healers, who also come and live among the regular people, among the ignorant masses, and can offer them healing treatments, can offer them enlightenment, basically. And that they are seeking, through their experimentation and through their works, to bring about this confrontation that we're talking about, and that the emergence of a champion to sort of rid Europe of what was seen by the Protestants of the continent as the superstitious tyranny, the anti-Christian thuggery of the Antichrist in Rome, the Pope. They're sort of the Jedi to the Jesuit Sith. They promise essentially that they will eventually, with their champion, overthrow the Pope and bring about this enlightened age, which is a more secularized sort of nerdier version of the old vision of Christ's return on earth. And they promise at one point that when the day comes and this hidden city reveals itself and the champion is crowned, that we promise more gold than both the Indies bring to the King of Spain. For Europe is with child and will bring forth a strong child who shall stand in need of a great godfather's gift. So, and there's a bunch of description of sigils, which are charged with this occult meaning that only the adept could understand and utilize. And the impact that this these pamphlets had on the situation can't really be totally quantified, but we do know that they circulated in the court of Frederick V of the Palatinate, who was the only Calvinist elector of the Holy Roman Empire, whose court in Heidelberg was the headquarters of not just Calvinist theology after the death of Calvin, sort of saw Geneva in decline in that respect, but also where free thinkers from across the continent came, because at that point, the Calvinists, because of their insistence on a separation of church and state, and churches not having sort of a say on civic judicial questions, seemed to be the place where free thought could most be generated. And so you have all these people showing up and living in this sort of a fantasy world, honestly. The Heidelberg court had these wonder rooms filled with these amazing contraptions powered by pneumatics and water wheels that had that created the illusion of automatic motion. And in that context, these papers appear, which say there is a lion amongst you who will come and who will redeem Europe for not just Christ, but for reason as an expression of God's will. And they took it up on them. They decided, let's do it and be heroes. And in retrospect, and even at the time, among people like, you know, John George of Saxony, who was the preeminent Lutheran elector in the Holy Roman Empire, Frederick's decision to accept the crown of Bohemia when the Bohemian rebels offer it to him after the defenestration of Prague, where they chuck the the imperial representatives out the window, is seen as madness, but fortified by an idea that they had created a durable military and diplomatic alliance with the nascent Dutch Republic and with England, but also fortified by this mystical understanding of their own place in the universe and Rosicrucianisms, the idea of these Rosicrucians existing somewhere, helping them, endorsing their actions, definitely impacted that. And in the years after the appearance of these pamphlets, there is sort of a Rosicrucian craze, where people are starting to, people who read the books or read the pamphlets, and explicitly say, do not come seeking us. Do not come and try to find the Rosicrucians. They decide, well, okay, if they're not going to come to me, then I will come to them by embodying their ideas. And so people start creating their own little societies to pass information along each other and to emulate the model that the Rosicrucians put in those pamphlets. And in France, for example, in the early 1620s, there's sort of a Rosicrucian panic. There's this fear amongst the Catholic majority that this subversive group is somewhere within their midst. There's an open question as to what degree, and Francis Yates and Rosicrucian Enlightenment suggest this, there's an open question as to what degree the entire Rosicrucian thing was not, in some respect, an intelligence operation by the court of James I, through John Dee, who was in Bohemia around the same time that the Rosicrucian books are being written. But there's no way of knowing that for sure. But what we do know is that the Rosicrucian idea contributed to this sense of the moment that everyone was living in as the defining moment, and reassured many people that that patriots somewhere were in control, that there were great minds greater and wiser than theirs put to the task of bringing about this universal enlightenment.
Yeah. So what I find fascinating about what you're talking about and about the Rosicrucians at this time, the Rosicrucian movement, I should back up, right? There probably wasn't a mystical order of Rosicrucians that produced these pamphlets. And as you said, there's all sorts of theories about where they came from, but they gave birth to Rosicrucianism. It's one of those inspiring things sometimes when you are in the realm of ideas, right? You know, there's this idea out there, I don't have to do action. I can just create the magical ideas that will change the world. And in this case, you know, it actually did have these real world effects. Now, listening to what you're talking about, it all sounds like pretty negative effects. It sounds like they were throwing gasoline on the fire at the time. But, you know, you mentioned Yeats's Rosicrucian Enlightenment, where I really love this idea, and I'm fascinated by this in general, right? About how the sword can be double-edged. Because the Rosicrucian pamphlets also led to lots of good things, like the war society in England, right? The rise of science. Of course, the ideas about science are very different at the time, but the pamphlets talk about, you know, the importance of the sciences. This double-edged sword is something that I can't get out of my head. But I want to back up a little bit. You mentioned in your preview for the show how it's very Game of Thrones, right?
Yeah.
So you have and folks, it's more complicated than Game of Thrones. Matt did a great job simplifying it, right? But you have all these personalities and all these big and large kingdoms, and you got great names like the Winter King and the Winter Queen, who you mentioned. But I wonder if we can back up a little bit to Rudy II, right? Yes. Rudolph II, who kind of, you know, it's kind of all his fault, maybe. So can you tell us a little bit about him, and, you know, how his orb pondering and his interest in Rosicrucianism and the esoteric was perhaps not what the world needed at the time?
Yeah, so Rudolph II, as the Holy Roman Emperor in the late 16th century, leading up to the crisis period, and he's presiding over a Holy Roman Empire that is becoming functionally ungovernable. There's the continued war in Hungary with the Turks, which is the overriding foreign policy issue of the Holy Roman Empire, which requires this constant negotiation with the restive electors, including the Protestant ones, in order to get money to fight this war with the Turks, which the Protestant electors have little interest in helping with. They would much rather leverage the situation to increase their own power relative to the emperors. And as I said, like this, the idea of the empire as a neutral arbiter of disputes has sort of gone by the wayside. And in that context, Rudolph basically kind of gives up on actually governing the empire. He refuses to marry or even consider a marriage or offspring that would secure like his line of succession. He moves the court of the emperor from Vienna to Prague, and he then spends his time living in a occult fantasy realm, surrounded by his cabinet of curiosities and his collections of odd ephemera and sacred and occult and profane books, with an idea perhaps that if I cannot use the terrestrial tools at my disposal to actually govern, perhaps there are supernatural ones, perhaps there are occult secrets that could be unleashed to gain some sort of control, some sort of sense of legibility to the world that I find myself thrust into. And there's a quote that I really like that was his brother said about him, one of his brothers, who he hated and who was in a constant conflict with, one of whom would eventually leverage all of the discontent in the empire to overthrow him, essentially, to gain his abdication. And one of his brothers said, "His Majesty is interested only in wizards, alchemists, Kabbalists, and the like, sparing no expense to find all kinds of treasures, learn secrets, and use scandalous ways of harming his enemies. He also has a whole library of magic books. He strives all the time to eliminate God completely so that he may in future serve a different master." And when you see this and you see like the Rosicrucians, there is this yearning for to transcend the limitations of the early modern world. And looking back, we can see that the contours of a new world with new tools is already being built, but beyond any individual person's sight. And because this is before, you know, the scientific revolution, before that vocabulary and world had been built, the language of Kabbalah and alchemy is the only language that exists to express that that understanding, that feeling, and that yearning, which the things like the fighting of the 30 Years' War and the state building capacity that comes with it is going to help unleash in the next century after that.
Yeah. I really like the ideas about John Dee being associated or being behind. And, you know, he's a great example of sometimes what you're talking about as well, right? Because he's making all these scientific breakthroughs, and he's also talking to angels, right? Mm-hmm. He has one foot in the heavens, and he is literally doing, if not this intelligence operation, he's running intelligence operations, right? Yeah. But at the same time, you know, going to the other world and doing all this holy stuff. You mentioned the Stuart court, right? There's legends in my family about being related to the royal Stuarts. We're not. We just, you know, raised sheep and had sex with them. So, but I've always been interested in the royal Stuarts because of those legends. And the royal Stuarts did have a role to play in sort of spreading esoterica around Europe. You know, that's another topic, but that does bring us back to Freddie Five and his wife, Elizabeth Stuart. So yes. Can you tell us more about the Winter King and the Winter Queen? And again, like you already mentioned this, but just like Rudolph, they sort of retreat and create this. I think it would have been wonderful at the time, right? Like I would have been there, you know.
Oh yeah,
this fantasy realm, cut off from the terrors that are outside. But you know, the thing about this fantasy realm is like Rudy II, they think this is going to fix everything, right? Like it's not a complete retreat from the world. Like they think that this is going to be the answer.
Yeah,
but tell us more about them and why they're called the Winter King and the Winter Queen.
Yeah, so. Frederick V was betrothed to Elizabeth Stuart, the daughter of James I, and they had an incredibly sumptuous, dreamlike wedding in London with the plays and fantastical devices and courts in London and then in Heidelberg, surrounded by filled with people who were insisting to both of them that they were special, that they were marked for destiny, Once they proceed to Heidelberg and set up shop there, they operate on those assumptions. And Frederick's major domo, Christian of Anhalt, who is his sort of strong right hand, tries to make that manifest by doing a rigorous diplomatic outreach to the Protestant powers of Europe to attempt to make the Palatinate in Germany the headquarters of this new Protestant alliance that would defeat not just get better terms from the Catholic powers of Europe, but to overthrow them, to bring down the Antichrist in Rome, and to bring down the superstitions and the tyrannies of the scheming Jesuits. Part of the reason they thought that is because they assumed that they had the support of Elizabeth's father, but unbeknownst to them, James's marriage of his daughter to Frederick was part of a broader strategy of peacekeeping, James saw James from England saw his best position not as the head of some holy war assembly, but rather as the pivot point between the confessional blocks, assuming the reality and the continuation of this, not trying to bring about the end of the world. And as a result, and so he was trying to marry his sons at the same time he married his daughter to Frederick. He was trying to marry his sons to the Habsburg, into the Habsburg families. He's trying to, disastrously, his son Charles went to Spain to try to get married, and it was a huge debacle. Then eventually he married her to one of the daughters of the French monarchy. There were, he was not interested in a holy war and in apocalypse, but that was something that was not dimly did not understood at all in Heidelberg. And so they carry forth this very risky decision to accept the Bohemian crown, go to Prague. And as soon as they do, they find that they really don't have any of the friends they thought they did. James is not happy at all about the decision. He does give some money and allows troops to be raised in England to be sent there, but there is no formal help there. The Dutch are pretty busy at the time. They can't really help too much. And the Lutheran princes are absolutely opposed because the Lutherans at this point hate Calvinists more than they hate Catholics, which is always how it goes. Because the Catholics, they're benighted. They're brainwashed by their Jesuit masters. You should know better. What are you doing with this baloney? So they're basically alone. The army that they're able to raise is funded by the Duke of Savoy, who's just doing it for like Littlefinger Gambo, machination reasons, and their military efforts are pretty disastrous. And within a year, they are driven out of Prague after the Battle of White Mountain, having ruled for one season, which is why they get called the Winter King and the Winter Queen. And then the rest of their life is spent kind of wandering the courts of Protestant Europe with their hat in their hand, trying to get people to keep them in the style they've become accustomed and to fund their restoration to their lands, which they never see. It's very, also when they are in Prague for that brief period, they actually almost immediately alienate the entire local population. They come in as the saviors, but the people of Prague are not Calvinists. The people of Prague have a well-established Hussite church. They were really the first protesters from the Catholic hegemony to actually sustain their independence with Jan Hus from a century before these events. And the church they have, the Ultra Church, has a lot of the pomp, the iconography, the ritual of Catholicism intact. And the Calvinist court that comes with Frederick, led by his court theologian Abraham Skultutis, are horrified by this. And they start knocking down stained glass windows and pulling reliquaries out. And the local population is horrified by this. And also Frederick and Elizabeth are a little weird. Frederick likes to swim nude in the Vistula River, which horrifies people. And that by the time Tilly shows up at White Mountain, they've kind of worn out their welcome, which again just shows, how fast fantasy can break apart once confronted with the reality that it's trying so hard to replace, but without the effort to do so, with the assumption that there's this magical shortcut to breaking through, which can only ever be disabused by the harsh emergence of reality.
Yeah, I really want to come back to that point, but I'm quickly going to do our Patreon commercial. Matt, don't be intimidated, but we have 44 patrons. So, hey, folks, if you'd like the show, you can support us for as little as $1 per piece of media per month. You can put a cap on that. I've given the keys to the kingdom to our other host, Jason, as well. We're trying to pump out more content, but we're only going to charge for 4 to 6 pieces of media. So we're hoping to get a lot more out there. We don't put anything behind a paywall. We don't really give you anything for being a patron, accept early access, which I've been a bit slow on, but I'm actually taking a bit of a break from the show. So I am banking a lot of shows. So you're going to get a lot of content, probably a couple months worth. You could do one-time donations at paypal.me/Gnostic. If you don't have any money, don't give us any money. Just tell people about the show. But we do have a Patreon goal, which is me not starving to death this winter. Now, Canada does have some great social programs. My backup plan is one called MAID. Just Google it. Matt, to sort of, your series is not just about the 17th century, right? You are making connections. I mean, this is the birth of the modern world. Some of this is probably sounding familiar to people now, like endless war, conspiracy theories, cloak and dagger stuff. But before we really dive into that, utopianism, it's something I think a lot about. Like, for instance, I thought that the world spirit was going to sweep out from Vermont and make some incremental changes to make the world slightly better. And that didn't happen. And I noticed when that didn't happen, a lot of people who also thought that went completely bonkers, right? Yeah. So there is, you know, I've seen already, and you know, when I was a young man, I was involved with a number of sort of utopian groups, both religious and political. Is utopianism dangerous, or do we need it? Because how else do we inspire people? How else do we get them moving? Like, you know, I am a big guy on this imagination stuff, right? This Jung, Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman, even like the Neoplatonic philosophers. Like, we need these stories. We need these myths. We need these narratives. So, yeah, what do you think about utopianism? Its uses, its dangers. Should it be abandoned?
I absolutely agree that it is. It cannot be dispensed with. It is necessary. It's the engine of all meaningful political act. I mean, if you do not have a utopian vision, what is the point? What are you seeking? But it is also dangerous. And I would say that the dividing line for me is that everyone has to have a utopian horizon in their mind that they, you know, in times of darkness can rotate in their head like a cube or whatever. But what needs to happen, what needs to be understood, is that you are not going to see it. That it is not for you. Utopia is not for us. Like, Moses doesn't get to go to the promised land, you know, like, you, that is part of it. And I feel like the danger of utopianism is that implicit and explicit assumption and understanding overriding your actions to try to push it into being so that you can experience it, so that you personally can experience it. But the thing is that if it is real, if these notions, if these ideas are real, and I do believe they are, then you should not have to see them in your lifetime. Their existence transcends time, and then you can live with them in your striving for them. That is where it can live, is in the striving for them. The actualization of this is in a world to come. Like, the world really did end for these people in the 17th century, and not just the ones who died in the horror, but anyone who survived. They were birthing a world that within a few generations would be in many fundamental ways unrecognizable. In a different psychic space, a different world was born, but without anyone knowing that's what they were doing, without anyone seeking it. They were seeking everything else except for the thing that emerged. And that is always going to be the case. And we have to, I think it is, to be responsible utopians, we have to accept that whatever emerges through our struggle and the struggles of people around us and people after us is going to be alien to us in a way that means, while it might be utopia eventually, it will not be our utopia. It will not be one that is legible to our experience, because we are living in, like, we are living at the end of a way of life, of an understanding of the world, of a heuristic that is extinguishing itself, that is exhausting itself, but and that will be replaced, and that is, I think, one of the things that helps me get away from the doomer mindset and the idea of the black pill nonsense is there is the black pill idea comes from the recognition that this way of life is ending, but then that's just nihilism unless it's paired with an understanding that of course something will come after, and it will be a development of what has come before. It will emerge from, but the people who are going to be struggling to build it are going to be doing so in conditions that are totally unfathomable to us and unimaginable to us. And that means that the world they're going to build is going to have truths embedded in it, unconscious assumptions about the nature of reality that we would not be able to recognize if we saw them. And that to me is how to square the utopian circle, to keep a utopia in your heart and to try to seek it in your life, to try to find it through struggling towards it, but always with the understanding that the actual thing, if it emerges, will be for others in another time, and that's not bad. I think that our hostility to that idea, our rejection of that idea, comes from our selfishness, comes from our connection to the machine that we're, you know, trying to rail against. Like we see its awfulness and we seek to dismantle it, but we also are made by it. And our desire to make the utopia of our minds into the world around us in the face of the reality that we find ourselves in is just it's that voice of Yael Batadoth. It's the Demiurge telling us, no, it must be me. It must be this consciousness, this conception, this world that is unremovable from it. Because if it's me, then it's this world, because this world made me. I am inextricably linked from it. But you have to acknowledge your own finitude, your own mortality, and the mortality of the system that birthed you, if you're going to truly embrace the implications, the radical implications of the utopian horizon.
Yeah, and I think that's I mean, you're using some Gnostic language here, but I think that is one of the central metaphors of Gnosticism. The Alma Minerva flies at dusk, people. We're not going to know where it's going to land. Yeah. Staying with this topic of narrative. So the first, I really like the first Rosicrucian Manifesto. The second one is just the Pope sucks. I don't find it that interesting. The third one is a trippy dream sequence. It doesn't really have these political...
The chemical marriage of Christian Rosenkreutz?
Yeah. It's awesome. Yeah. It's great, right? I don't know what it means, but you can read it, you can decode it, you can dream about it. It's a lot of fun.
It's an I Ching. It's some sticks to throw and to look at and to in the seeking of order from that, in the seeking of coherence from it, it's going to reveal itself. And then the truth of your observation comes from your application of it.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think it's constructed to work exactly like that, right? Yeah. So with this idea, like, you know, you're someone who's been thinking a lot about religion, spirituality the last couple of years, and staying on this topic of narrative, which is, you know, I'm also involved with the mindfulness world, with the secular mindfulness world, and sometimes, please keep giving me money for doing that, anybody who are my clients, but sometimes... You know, I ponder and I wonder that we can't just sit people down and teach them how to do these spiritual technologies. We can't just tell them these spiritual morals. We're storytelling animals. And it seems that we need these narratives and myths to fully interact and understand. I shouldn't say understand, to fully interact with the mystery. So, mm-hmm. like, you know, I guess my question is, like, when you start your cult, are you going to have an origin story, right? Like, is there going to be aliens? Is there going to be a virgin birth? You know, I'm being facetious, but what do you think about this. Like, do we need this narrative? Do we need this myth? Just like you're talking about utopianism, if we want to explore the mystery of spirituality, the mystery of religion, the mystery of the bigger questions.
Yeah, I think you do. I know that in my own mind, I can coming back to, because yeah, I try to resist the urge to narrativize, right? To just experience the sensation and to, but you know, that moment is bracketed, you know, by narrative. It has to be. And so coming out of that experience, there is the instant narrativizing of it and the instant contextualizing of it. It's, you cannot avoid that. If you want to live among people and communicate with them and communicate with yourself, it's not optional. I get aliens as a metaphor, and it's one that speaks to me as someone who, you know, showed up just too late in time for the supernatural understanding of religious beings to like angels, you know. John Dee would have been into aliens if he was born in the 20th century.
Absolutely.
I'm stuck with aliens, but not aliens as space travelers. To me, aliens as interdimensional emissaries.
Machine elves?
Huh?
Machine elves?
Yeah. Yeah. Or honestly, you know, humans, you know, from a different Earth than ours that exists, you know, in the same space as all things do. You know, it's everything is next to each other. It's all, there's no real distance from consciousness. Like, it's one field. It's just, you know, our very select sliver of perception of it. And, you know, so my mind often, when I'm, you know, when I'm trying to come down and arrange my feelings about, like, the sensations that I've had, it usually comes back to some narrative of a people recognizably human to me, recognizably part of the human pageant that I know from history and from the world around me, reaching a point where technology and humanity are fused not to the will of an algorithm and to the will of the machine, which is what we're building right now, but where the mere technology is truly suborned to a human will, not an individual will, which is what the people who are building this machine of death think they're doing. They think they're building something that they will be the enthroned lords of for eternity, but that's what the devil tells you, you fucking idiots. Like, that's the pitch of Satan. Is that, yeah, you'll be right in hand. It'll be great. And then you find out, no, you're dying strapped to a gurney with a fucking Ethernet cord plugged into a MacBook. But a universal human consciousness that is networked through technology, and in so doing is able to break through, shatter shatter the bars of the Black Iron Prison and pass and allow for the transmission, you know, of knowledge through these membranes that to us appear completely impermeable.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I say this on the show all the time, but, you know, you're a podcaster. Everybody ends up saying the same things all the time, mm-hmm. because we have our pet theories and our pet stock phrases. But the early Gnostics, they don't seem to quite have the language for it yet. But when they're describing the Demiurge and the Archons, it's a machine intelligence. It's artificial mm-hmm. intelligence.
Yes.
And there's the scholar I really like, Jonathan Kahana Bloom, Dr. Jonathan Kahana Bloom, who says that the Gnostics are the first critical theorists, and they're looking at a self-replicating systems, mm-hmm. right? The system of empire that is on yes. the earth, and how it acts like an artificial intelligence, how it acts like a god that isn't a god. Mm-hmm. And now I think, you know, 2,000 years later, we now have the language to properly describe what they were talking about. Now, that said, I think the Gnostics, the early Gnostics, I'm not going to say they were just critical theorists, right? They lived in a very different world from us. They thought that this was probably a reflection of some spiritual realities as well, right? I'm not going to say they were, you know, some sort of like atheist writing in code, right. But these things probably worked on levels for them. So, mm-hmm. so the machine, Matthew, to tie in what you're talking about, so why it might matter even more for people's lives. In this case, I mean your mini series, Hell on Earth, like the birth of the modern world and the birth of the market system. How does this get like? And I know this is a thesis, and you probably have hours where you're explaining this, but you know, how does the market system come out of the 30 Years' War?
So by the 17th century, you see across Eurasia, basically across that, you know, the Jared Diamond stretch, where you have really intense agricultural production in these hierarchical class societies that's able to generate significant surplus and lead to a real demographic boom. And in doing that, it creates an unprecedented amount of technological innovation. But it is discrete. It is people in places making, trying to adjust to their conditions, trying to survive under the conditions of empire that are imposed upon them. But they cannot bring those innovations together towards a agreed upon goal. They're held to discrete purposes. And in places like China, the central authority of the empire explicitly reduces the capacity of these innovations to revolutionize, to create a new level of technological intensity because of their incredibly destabilizing power, because the machine does not care about the individual rules of individual sovereigns or systems of human control. It is control itself.
Yeah.
Who is at the helm? Who is running the thing? Sorry. Oh. Who's running the thing is trivial to them, because it is an inhuman consciousness. And so in places where you have a powerful authority that is able to recognize this threat, that these market innovations are suppressed. And in China specifically, you see the most, in the 17th century specifically, the most effective merchants to emerge out of this matrix leave. They become this diaspora that spreads throughout Asia, and becomes like a network of trade nodes there. But within China itself, these innovations, the economic, technological, are suppressed. In Europe at the same period, where you have these medium-sized states in competition with each other, and no central authority overriding anyone, the closest you have is this Holy Roman Emperor, which has been declining in its actual effective authority since Charlemagne died, basically. And in that context, all of these innovations are reluctantly but eventually embraced by every sovereign, even though they undermine their long-term power, because they serve their short-term interests of their conflict with the other dynasties. And this period, the 17th century, is when the incredibly unstable social structure that exists, which is you have a market system emerging spontaneously in the cities of Europe, overlaid with a still fully feudal political structure, and which has been under immense pressure, and the cracks have started showing for 100 years, the Reformation being one of the significant cultural manifestations of this conflict between these two things, the marketized economy of the cities and a feudal structure, feudal political and social structure. they're already at like a terminal crisis, much like they were before the Black Death emerged in the 14th century. And here, the accelerant that pushes things into conflagration and eventually the emergence of states like the Dutch Republic and England willing to wield all of these developments along one specific line by empowering their middle class, their merchant urban class, is the Little Ice Age. It is this very rapid drop in global temperatures that hits Europe especially hard in the early to mid 17th century, a drop in a few decades of 2.5 degrees, which massively reduces the agricultural output of Europe, which the entire system depended on, and which led every power that be everywhere to frantically find any way to maintain their power in this crisis condition. And the only way that they could is by empowering this new market economy. And specifically, the Dutch and the English are able to do that, because they are the most marginal at the time. And it's the marginality that pushes them in that direction. Like the fact that England was in the Middle Ages sort of a backwater of Europe, a sheep or a wool exporting monoculture, is one of the main reasons that they become the hearth of capitalism, is because they have a motivation to seek an advancement, to prevent being annihilated by their opponents, that more secure, more fertile polities don't have. And it's that motivation that pushes them to bring together all of these innovations that emerge in places like, you know, the Italian city-states of the medieval era, and the German cities of the Holy Roman Empire and the Dutch Republic, and bring them together to a package that is able to compete and outcompete the still sort of hybridized feudal systems that the rest of the continent still has.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I get some angry emails. You know, we are sponsored by a Gnostic church. We can't, tell people to vote for a specific politician's parties, agitate for any specific politics. But I think regardless of where you are on the political spectrum, you're probably getting a lot out of what Matthew's talking about. And I think now, both on the left and the right, particularly the more mainstream cultural left and right, there's this real idea that we're being ground up and being spit out of the machine, right? You may have some different definitions of what the machine is, but it does seem to be a common idea right now. So I'm just doing that little song and dance. We're talking about 17th century people before, when I talk about the two C words, but this isn't a fully fleshed out idea. I think I'm going to write a paper on it. I'll send it to you. Yakov Burma, we don't get Yakov Burma without Rosicrucianism and the 30-Year War, right? So he's very influenced by the Rosicrucian manifestos. He's very influenced by the utopian ideas that are floating around. He sees the chaos of the 30 Years' War, and he believes that is going to end in the Age of the Lily and in the utopianism. So we don't get his output without that. Without Yakov Burma, we don't get Hegel and dialectics. And without Hegel and dialectics, we don't get Marx and dialectical materialism. So we see both the birth of, I would propose, capitalism and communism at this time. Mm-hmm. But this is sort of embarrassing. So as I've mentioned before, and I know everybody out there is shocked, they see my youthful face and how hip and cool I am, and they're like, this young guy, he's bussing. But I am middle-aged, and you know, lately I've been getting into that sort of like Zizek, Todd McGowan, Lacan bullshit, right? Which is usually something that undergrads get into. And Matt, I'm asking you to free associate, talk about psychoanalysis. Maybe you won't have an answer for this, but for a long time we've known that there's strong connections between Protestantism and the market system and the way we act now, right? Mm-hmm. So, for instance, you know, when you're to work is godly in under Calvinism, mm-hmm. and a lot of people who are quote unquote no longer religious, they feel guilty when they're not working all the time, right? So there's a great example. But, you know, I propose that it goes deeper, that we have a religious relationship to the market system in an even deeper way, which is the commodity form, right? Mm-hmm. It is, we have a religious relationship specifically to the commodity form.
Absolutely.
Even Marx talks about this. Yeah. So it's not the greatest of insights. But I suspect that it is tied up with Protestantism, and I suspect that its origins are here, right, in the 30 Years' War. So, mm-hmm. like, why, what do you think the link is between this chaos, Protestantism, and our perhaps unconscious religious relationship to the commodity form? Do you have any speculation about that?
Yeah, the Protestant Reformation, to me, is in part a psychological recognition that the marketized world that people were living in could not sustain the god of feudalism, who was a god of ritual, who was a public god, a god affirmed by every structure of existence, the church, the princes, everyone was on the same page about a god who was manifest in things like the Eucharist. Like you get enough Christians in a room together and God shows up in a piece of bread. Like that what could be sustained in feudalism at the pace, the rural pace of feudal life, but the rapidly increased speed and of life, the increased necessity of treating, if you're going to be a merchant, if you're going to live in the market, an increased need to treat others as strangers, as aliens to you, not as brothers in Christ. Like they might be theoretically, but that you cannot treat them that way or else you'll lose your shirt. So you have to treat them as strangers. You have to treat them as people who you can take advantage of, which is something that medieval church understood was deeply undermining to their authority. That's why they said, no, let the Jews do that. Let Jews lend money. And then once in a while, if there's a bad enough harvest, we'll go and kill some of them and feel better about ourselves. And we get to keep our understanding of God, and we get to keep the real presence of the Eucharist and the necessity of this marketized society to take advantage means that you can't live that way anymore, which means you get enough Christians in a room together and God is gone. The bread is just bread now. And if that's the case, where does God go? And God goes into your mind. God becomes functionally you. That's the thing, is that God is a projection of your own mind. The social God of medieval Catholicism is replicated in social ritual. It is something beyond you. It is something that is more than you and has to be, something that is a mystery. That's why you don't ask the question of, well, oh, wait a minute, how's the God in this way for what? You're saying if a dog eats it, that's God? Those kind of questions don't emerge. Because the totality of life pushes them out. They would not occur, but it is the isolation. It is the solitude of market life that banishes that idea, that banishes our social faith and demands a rational and a reasoned understanding of God, which then becomes the fixation of these people. It's very, like you look at Luther and Calvin, they thought, I believe both of them believed, that if people got the notion of grace, and they would then not worry about God, they wouldn't worry. The burden would be released. They would be able to act again as brothers in Christ because they would know that they were saved. But if you're living isolated, if you are living in competition, if you are living this new life in this new sterile market world, then all you end up thinking is how unworthy you are of salvation. That becomes the only thing you can think about. And so God is just your conscience, basically. God is the echoing voice of a world that is gone and that you cannot return to. And so the market becomes the place where you try to keep that voice at bay. And Calvinism specifically becomes a way to replace the comfort of salvation that came from living in a universal church, because in medieval Catholicism, basically nobody thought they were going to hell. Hell is for witches and Jews. You go to purgatory, doesn't sound great, but hey, if you have enough friends and family, if you live your life well enough, they're going to be paying priests to do services for you. They're going to be they're going to look at the Pope's fingernail. That they're going to get you out. They're going to spring you. It's a chain of responsibility that you're part of. I'll get my grandpa out and he'll get me out, and my kids will get me out, and I get to go to heaven. That's gone. There is just the saved and the damned who can never be redeemed, who can never be bought out. No intercession will save. And who can that be? If you accept predestination, that the logic, the ironclad logic of Calvinism, then how can you know? And the only answer becomes those who God favors in life. And God's favors are bestowed by the market. And so that's the world we still live in. And like the most secular liberal in America, who has never believed in God for a minute of his life, who by the time he was six, is like, God, methinks not, still operates from that assumption, from that belief. Because if this is the only world, then advancing within it and getting the world's benefits, advancing in the market, succeeding through work, is the only value. It still is. It's just, but there is this other side, like this moment, the Reformation and the time that comes later creates, you know, this Calvinist morality that becomes the mindset of capitalism to this day, but it also creates the Anabaptists. It also creates this idea of, if we are all, you know, if there is a priesthood of believers, then we actually can treat one another as believers. But that comes in conflict with the social order as is, with the class system as is. And that is why I think you really do have to look at the emergence of socialism in the 19th century as the secularized continuation of that note, which starts with the Gnostics, goes through all of Christianity, which is created by Christianity as a artifact of class rule, but which challenges it and which tries to overcome it. And that's been the struggle throughout European and now human history, once the universalization of capitalism happens. And it now, I think, is the global dream of emancipation.
Yeah, exactly. That's a perfect point to start wrapping up. I forgot to talk about Michael Mayer. We did a show on him, but he was in the court of Rudolf II and basically drove himself insane looking for the Rosicrucians. But he was a fascinating man who created some fascinating texts. A closing question, Matt. You know, so you guest on a lot of podcasts. You're active on Twitter. So, you know, your reply guys and podcast hosts, they're always trying to riff with you and your fellow Chapos. So my closing question is, which of the hosts of Chapo Trap House is most likely to be Mark David Chapman by one of your reply guys?
Felix, 100%. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I'm number two, but Felix is definitely number one. Because it's precisely because of that riff question. We already have an alarming number of people who have essentially become supervillains because they did not get sufficient recognition from Felix for his replies. So it stands to reason that one of those is going to finally tip over the edge, and he's going to be his slave in the afterlife.
Absolutely. Okay, so it's Hell on Earth. It's patreon.com/ChapoTrapHouse. We are recording this. You know, things live online forever. We're recording this in December 2022. It's going to be available January 2023. Definitely check that out. You know, there's a good chance that this is the only episode of this show that you'll ever listen to or watch. But, you know, check out some of the others. Matt was on another one. You might like some. If you're interested in Gnosticism, my church does have a free course. It's joeandite.org/learn we're high church liturgical Gnosticism, so you can do your trad stuff about becoming a fascist. The free course does kind of sound a little Scientology, but it's an online course. It's fun. It's great. Check it out.
There's no e-meter.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah, we will send you a free e-meter. You know, that's it. Thanks again, Matt.
Thank you.
Okay, bye, everyone.